in.
Good afternoon, book lovers, and welcome to Reader's Delight. I'm your host, Suzanne Craig-Wittick, author of several books and short story collections, as well as editor-in-chief of Dark Winter Press and Literary Magazine. In conjunction with CKMS 102.7 Radio Waterloo and the KW Writers Alliance, we endeavor to bring writers and readers together and promote our vibrant literary community. Today is Sunday, August 23rd, and I'll be joined by three talented authors, Marie-Josée Poisson, David Lee, and Kevin R. Wilson, who will be discussing their work with me before reading excerpts from their writing. I'll also be joined by Vanessa from Lockwood Books in St. Thomas, Ontario, who will tell us what's in a name. And now, sit back and enjoy today's episode of Reader's Delight. First up, I'm excited to have Marie-Josée Poisson on the show. Before becoming a full-time novelist, Marie-Josée Poisson spent 3 years working in an advertising agency in Dubai and then returned to Quebec to take on a senior-level communications roles at TV5Monde and the École supérieure du ballet du Québec. This was followed by 5 years as editor-in-chief of Le Magazine de la Place des Arts, the publication of Montreal's largest venue for cultural events. Ultimately, she left her career to focus on her dream of writing a novel and ended up writing three of them. Passionate about history, she spent 5 years researching and writing the first novel in her Liés par les Sang series, a trilogy focused on well-known historical figures and investigations into their genealogies. Bloodbound, Unlacing Secret Ties, Guernica Editions 2026, is the first novel in this trilogy to be translated into English. Welcome, Marie-Josée.
Hi, how are you, Susan?
Very good. It's so nice to have you on the show today.
Well, same here. I'm honored, actually.
Oh, I'm so interested about your series. So Bloodbound, Unlacing Secret Ties was originally written in French, and it was recently translated. I think this spring it was released with Guernica Editions. Can you tell us about that process and what it was like to work with a translator?
Yes, I thoroughly enjoyed the process, even though it took a full year to get it done. I worked with Floralie Bendit, mm-hmm. who came highly recommended by a fellow author and friend, Caroline van der Meer. And one thing that we did in this whole translation adventure, it was more of a rewriting than strictly a translation, mm-hmm. because Floralie is well-educated in French. She studied in one of Quebec's finest colleges, Brébeuf. So she knew not only all about the language, but also about all the nuances of the Quebec culture. So I didn't have to explain everything. It just flowed. So it was really really interesting, because for me, even though I do speak English and I work for a bilingual publication, I would not consider doing the translation myself, because I wanted to put the proper spin on things, to find someone who would convey not only my meaning, but also the feelings and the ambience of the novel and all that. So the translation itself was really a great process.
Oh, that's excellent. It's hard sometimes, I imagine, to have somebody kind of take over your book and translate it, and you don't want just that word for word. I mean, there are idioms and there's, as you said, nuances that have to be carefully considered, right?
Oh, exactly. We tried working with somebody else. The way we do it is we ask the translator to translate an excerpt from the book. And with the first one, that wasn't it, because I had to go over and correct and correct and correct. With Floralie, of course, we made changes, because mm-hmm. We didn't always see eye to eye, but we always came up with a solution that was really satisfactory to me. So,
That's great. Yeah. So Bloodbound is a historical mystery that links the past with the present. Tell us a little bit about that and the reason that you became so interested in Madame de Pompadour, who was the mistress to King Louis XV.
Yeah, well, the reason is very simple, really. My family name is Poisson, and she was born Jeanne Antoinette Poisson. So when I found out about that, I thought, oh, I'm not sure I want to be associated with that person, because for many people, she went down in history as, like you mentioned, the mistress of King Louis XV, Louis XV. And to a lot of people, being the official mistress was like being a whore, which she mm-hmm. was not. favorite, the favorite one of the king, is like an official position at the court of Versailles. And once you're recognized as such, people are supposed to respect that and all that. So anyways, I got interested in her also because I found out that she also suffered quite a bit from being called Poisson. I did. Yeah. I mean, the bus ride to high school was horrible.
Oh.
You can imagine. It's yeah. a name, you know, being called fish is something that lends itself to mockery and all sorts of teasing. But with Madame de Pompadour, it was much worse than that, because the nobles at the king of at the court of Versailles really mocked that name, because it meant that she wasn't born a noble. She was born bourgeoise,
right.
And she was ennobled by King Louis XV in order to become the official mistress. So much so that some very clever ministers started writing poisonous verses, poetry about her, mocking her name and all that. And these were published, and you know, wow. Anyways, it was horrible. So it all started with the name, and it's interesting that you will have somebody on your show that that talks about what's in a name.
Yes.
in hearing their take on this. So anyways, that's how I first got interested in this, and it was the first spark for the novel, really.
Well, I know that my listeners are dying to hear from you and have you read some of the novel. Would you be able to read some of it for us now?
Yeah, sure.
Excellent.
Ready. Okay. So first, I'd just like to give you in a nutshell the plot. It
okay.
will be easier to understand the
text. Okay.
So in a nutshell, a hidden chamber, a bloodstained gown, and a forgotten lineage. One Montreal woman's search for her roots may overturn a long-accepted truth about Madame de Pompadour, one of France's famous, some would say infamous, historical figure. So the context of the excerpt is a conversation between Geoffroy Lhuillier, who's one of my main characters. He's a fashion historian who authenticates a blood-stained dress.
Mm-hmm.
Found at the Élysée, within the walls of the Élysée Palace, which is today's presidential house, palace, Paris. And he has this conversation with the Élysée's curator. And they talk about the dress, because the dress is really at the core of my novel. It's like a piece of evidence. It's a bit like crime and mystery. So,
okay.
Behind Borde, who's the Élysée's curator, a portrait hung on the wall. The historian became unsettled when he realized who it was. The figure was easy to identify, surrounded by the words Jean-Frédéric Philippot, Comte de Maurepas, Secrétaire d'État, Commandeur des Ordres du Roi. The author of the Poissonade, the poisonous poems. Lou had told him about the humiliation she had endured in Montreal after a mocking recitation. Geoffroy felt the same disgust for the individual taunting him with his eternally condescending smile. I see you've recognized my friend Maurepas. His relationship with the Marquise was rather, how should I put it, turbulent. Bob said, remembering the way Bob had treated his communications director at the press conference, Geoffroy said to himself, he must have been a complete misogynist, just like you. The fact that you chose this particular portrait speaks volume. Maurepas loathed Jeanne Antoinette with poisonous refinement, an accomplished son of a bitch. He was increasingly convinced that Bord was simply using the Marquise to boost his reputation. I insisted on meeting you, Geoffroy said, because there have been new developments in the matter you so eloquently presented to the journalists yesterday. I'm listening, said Bald, ever the good prince, granting an audience. He only heard the compliment in Geoffrey's word, impervious to the underlying sarcasm. Because of all the blood on the fabric of the three-tiered dress, Geoffrey said, I thought it was to have forensic analysis performed. Unfortunately, I didn't get the results until this morning. Too late for the press conference. Let me assure you right away that no crime was committed against the Marquis, Geoffrey said. But the tests did establish or confirm certain facts. He concisely summarized Thierry's conclusion. Thierry is the policeman who did the analysis, and advised Bord that the detailed report had already been emailed to him. That's not all, he said. We found something inside the dress, another discovery, even more significant. Bord placed his bony hands on top of his antique desk, bent his spindly torso, and extended his turkey neck. He was all ears, eager to hear something that would allow him to get back on his pedestal. Geoffroy carefully removed the plastic-sealed yellowed sheets from a cardboard folder and spread them across the garnet leather in front of the graying 50-something-year-old. Bob didn't touch them. He read them, slowly at first, then faster and faster. Geoffroy gauged his mounting interest by the acceleration of his eye movements. As Bob went on, his skin color changed from healthy pink to cardiac red. Geoffroy hoped the man didn't have any heart problems. He mentally reviewed the resuscitation techniques that all good swimmers, like himself, must know. Better safe than sorry. What the hell is this? Bob said, cut to the quick, as if his intelligence had been insulted. A letter addressed to the Marquise? Okay. But signed by her son? It's impossible. A sham. There's no historical trace. No mention of a descendant from Madame de Pompadour. She did have a firstborn who died as an infant, like so many others in that era. Then a daughter who passed away at a young age. But that's it. How do you explain this letter? It's hardly credible. A forgery, for sure. So that's it. The tone.
Oh, you leave it on the cliffhanger. It's a mystery. Oh, I love that. Oh, thank you. And you must have done a lot of research as well to get, I mean, it was very, very vivid. I mean, I'm sure my listeners enjoyed that very much. Where can people find out more about you and the book and your writing?
Well, about me, I recommend my website, because this is where I archive really all the press coverage I'm getting. And I'm pleased to say that I'm getting quite a bit of attention for the book. So that gives readers a good idea of what goes on in the book. And there's also my bio and all that. So I think that's the best spot. Otherwise, I'm on Facebook and Instagram.
Yeah, no, I was on your website and it is terrific. You've got so many great reviews and all kinds of things for the book. So I highly encourage our listeners to go there. And the website is just
bloodbound.ca.
Bloodbound.ca. Yes, bloodbound.ca. All right. Thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And that was Marie-Josée Poisson. Next, I'm happy to welcome David Lee on the show. David Lee is the author of Mythical Man, Anne Struther Books 2020, and Dream of Me as Water, Anne Struther Books 2022, both shortlisted for ReLit Poetry Awards. He is co-editor with Daniel Zamparelli of Queer Little Nightmares, Arsenal Pulp Press 2022. His work has appeared widely in anthologies and literary journals, and he is the recipient of the ex-Puritan's Austin Clark Prize in Literary Excellence. He is poetry editor at This Magazine and serves on the editorial board of Poplar Press, the speculative fiction imprint of Walsack and Wynne. His most recent publication is the fantasy novel Not All Dragons, Poplar Press 2026. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me, Suzanne.
Also happy to have you on the show. So I was looking at your bio and everything, and I realized that most of your published work so far has been poetry, but Not All Dragons is a fantasy novel. So how did that come about? Was it a conscious decision to change genres, or was it just a natural extension of the kind of writing you've been doing?
Definitely a little bit of both. I think I've always wanted to write a novel. So that was always kind of on the horizon for me, but it kind of transformed from themes and images that have appeared in my poetry. So yeah, it was kind of, it felt like a very natural progression, slipping into that kind of form
So being a
for
poet
me.
really kind
Yeah.
of informed your fantasy writing.
I think so. Yeah. Because I always considered my poems kind of little snapshots of little scenes, either belonging to a larger narrative, or not. But they always have this kind of fantasy speculative element to them that I enjoy writing in. So for Not All Dragons, it definitely came from a poem in Mythical Man, which was called Boy. The poem was a very short piece about just a boy who was in the woods, and I know he was hurt and lost, and he was hiding under a bunch of moths. But that
Did you
imagery
say moss or
changed when
moths?
it, yeah, moths, like the insects.
Oh, okay.
So, but then that imagery changed, as I thought about him more and what he was and who he was. And then, yeah, he kind of went from the poem to the novel. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So what is it about fantasy that really appeals to you then? Because I mean, you could have taken that idea and morphed it into almost anything, but it became fantasy. What is it that appeals to you about the fantasy genre?
I think it's not only in a genre for an escape reading. I think there's a lot of value in it for like understanding our world and ourselves. I think I like allegorical writing, and that's this, and All Dragons is very much that, where there is fantasy and it's set in very fantastical world with creatures, but there's this kind of literary aspect to it where it kind of speaks to more than just what's happening in fantasy wise. It speaks to kind of a bit more like human understanding and identity and connection to each other.
Right. And
So I just kind of like the fluidity of fantasy. I can play with that a bit more and yeah, just expand on it with kind of magical imagery.
you're not really tied to any kind of reality, right?
Exactly. Yes, I do like that kind of being untethered to something, to anything while I'm writing. Being tethered and untethered at the same time, tethered to like the logic of the magical world and the magic systems, but within that kind of realm, you can feel a bit more freed in what you convey through the writing.
And you mentioned identity. What's the significance of the title, and how does it tie back maybe to the idea of identity?
Yeah, the title was very happy of when I came up with it. I think it reflects a lot of what is kind of conveyed in my poetry titles, but because the book is about identity and uses the trope of dragons to kind of stand for that, without giving too many spoilers, Not All Dragons, it can mean a plenitude of things. It's kind of a fill in the blank title. Not all dragons are what, right? It's multifaceted in how you approach the image and idea of a dragon and how the story kind of flips out on its head a little
So
bit.
as the reader reads through the book, they'll be able to fill in that blank for themselves.
I think so. Yeah. As the protagonist moves through his journey, discovering who he is, and more importantly, or just as importantly, what he is and what that means. Yeah.
Do the moths come back at all?
They actually, it's interesting. Not really. There are kind of insectoid imagery a little bit in how certain creatures are portrayed. I think the fae, which is what I call the fairies in the book, they remind me a bit of some sort of insect creature a little bit. But yeah, the moths did not come
They morphed into
fully.
dragons,
A
right?
little bit, yeah,
Yeah.
more or
Oh,
less so.
it's interesting. Well, you're going to be doing a reading from Not All Dragons, so do you want to give us a little bit of context, and then you can launch into it anytime you're ready?
Yeah, I think I'm just gonna start. I'll read the entire prologue. It's not too long. It kind of sets up the scene and really, this prologue is it was some obviously being the first thing that people read. I rewrote it quite a bit in terms of like perspective and what I wanted to reveal slash not reveal in it. But yeah, I hope it does a good job of grounding the reader in like Reese, who's the protagonist, in his shoes, more or less. So the prologue. The sea wept with Reese, each wave breaking like a breath he couldn't catch. Clouds aglow in pink and orange stretched above the western coast of Lanilia. Dawn over the Wilnean sea always echoed the blush of succulent fruit to him. Memories bloomed on his tongue of the sharp, citrusy burst of sun pearls and the lingering spiced warmth of morning berries. Reese stood, motionless, clutching the flower bud in his hand, rubbing its soft petals. He wondered if he would soon forget the taste of his favorite fruits as well. Tide lights bloom to be eaten at sunrise. The instructions hissed through his mind before it opens. Reese held the charcoal black flower up against the sun cresting the horizon. It glistened like a night sky speckled with stars. A gift from the sea to take him away. A forceful wind picked up and a fine sea mist enveloped his body after another tidal crash. He curled his toes with a chill. Then the first petal peeled open. He put the entire bud into his mouth and chewed, bitterly herbaceous at first, tolerable until it melted into something pungent and rancid. Reese stifled a gag with his hand. He swallowed, tears pricking the corners of his eyes. It would work quickly, he'd been told. His life and memories would burn out and peel away from him like skin on spoiled morning berries. His body stripped of every fiber meant to hold what he loved. But beneath the surface of his certainty, a quiet panic rippled through his chest. The waves came harder. The wind intensified, pushing him to stagger back away from the water. He fell to his hands and knees, a dizzying, head-pounding spell, and let loose a groan of agony like something dredged up from the deep. His ears rang sharp and steady. Muscles in his back knotted, seized, while bone ground against bone. It was like his back was contorting to betray its own shape. For a fleeting moment, the sensation reminded Reese of a time when he'd fallen from a great height and landed on a prickly bush. The almost memory was quickly washed away when the ocean, once clear, fractured into painful glares of white light. His back continued to ache while the rest of his body tensed against an icy chill flowing beneath his skin with uncanny purpose. A thin layer of his skin flaked off. Arms, hands, chest. Fingers trembling, Reese touched the cool sting along his face as the skin of his fingertips peeled off and twisted in the breeze. Then, suddenly, it surged. The ache of his muscles, the sting of his skin sloughing off, bright and violent on his back. Reese turned, gasping at blue flames curling out of his flesh, flames that burned with no heat, as they licked icily against him. He experienced a terrible inkling that something essential, something he was always meant to have, to know, was fading. It was as if he held both answer and question, but they dissolved before he could begin to grasp what was happening. A crash of water swallowed his scream, like the sea itself was refusing to let his agony be heard. His skull felt like it was being cleaved in two. As the flames flickered, he whipped his head about his surroundings, unable to discern where he was. A suspicion that the landscape looked familiar slipped away just as quickly as it came. Each time he felt he was nearing recognition, details burned away faster than he could hold them. In the empty spaces they left behind festered a teary panic. The cold rock cut into his skin when his head smacked the ground. He lay there, motionless, exposed, vulnerable, and feeling utterly out of control as his own body raged against him. Reese stared at his palm, bloody from where it struck rock. The agony in his muscles was finally beginning to dissipate, coils of pain loosening one by one. Where the pain faded, a cold ache curled in its absence. He felt a delicate prickle on his skin. It had started to rain. The droplets quickened, exploding on the rock like brittle pearls. Reese's consciousness waned until a boom of thunder exploded overhead, startling him, but his body was too ruined, too hollowed out by pain to fully respond. Another rumble of thunder rolled over the water, deep enough this time to rattle his ribs. He let it pass, too exhausted to stand, too broken to care. When sleep came finally, it took him the way tides reclaim tide pools, slow and inevitable. But even as the sea foam flowed over him, what lay within remained. Yeah, and that's how the book starts, and that's how we're introduced to Reese, kind of like very in the middle of his life and in the middle of an occurrence that he's going through.
What kind of character is Reese? How would you like characterize him?
I would say he is not the typical hero that you would expect in a fantasy novel. He is not gifted in any way. He is not particularly, I would say, very outrightly brave. He has a quietness to him, I think, that I liked to kind of explore a little bit, that he is very absorbing of everything that's happening around him before he speaks. He's a quiet hero.
I like that. I can tell too. I mean, you channeling the poetry, that was beautifully lyrical as you were reading. I was just the imagery is so vivid and so beautiful. He's going through a lot of pain, but it's
Thanks.
told in a way that, you can really visualize it as well. So I can see the poetry coming through there.
Yeah, I really like playing in most of my writing in having a certain event or perspective that's uncomfortable unfolding before you as a reader, but also, juxtaposing that in a very beautiful, enticing kind of setting. And yeah, I like kind of framing those kind of ugly moments, I
Yeah.
think.
And I mean, presenting him
That
that
way.
way, as a reader myself, like, it makes me want him to be okay. You know what I mean? Like, you
Oh.
empathize with him, and it's like, please, it's a prologue. I hope this guy's okay.
I really, I think, looking at that scene objectively, dropped in the middle, I feel it's very feels very much aftermathy of, and he definitely goes through
So you
it.
have to read on in the book to find out how we get to that point then.
Yes, yeah, a little bit.
Exactly. So what's next for you? Is this the first book in a series? Are you writing another book, with the same characters, or are you just like it's a one-off, you're going somewhere else?
Yeah, I've thought about it, and I've had some sort of ideas going. I think in terms of what the book has introduced in the world and the creatures and the mythology kind of tied to each one, there will be a second book eventually. Whereas, I mean, in terms of following kind of Reese's story, I feel very comfortable with where he ends up at the end of this novel, and that's kind of like the point that he needs to arrive at. I think anything after, he would only appear as kind of like a side character or like a cameo.
Oh,
I
cameo.
really want to explore kind of like the witches in the book and how they kind of behave. And their lore is something that was really unexpected, that kind of came up when I was writing. So yeah, I definitely want to come back to the world of Lanilia. But Reese will play a different role in, I kind of a more of a, he's more, firm in who he is and but still curious, and that kind of plays into, I think, what happens around him in the second book, if it ever comes, how it comes together how I want
I know.
it
Second books are sometimes harder to write, right?
I guess, I think so. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think my second poetry collection was a bit harder to write, and the third one definitely took a longer time to put together. So I think the novel will be, just as grueling.
So where can people find out more about you and your work?
You can find me online if you just Google, from my website, David Lee Writes. I'm known as David Lee Writes across, on my Instagram. Instagram is where I'm most active, so I would really suggest people to go there. That's kind of where I announce all my work and news and whatnot. But yeah,
And your books
definitely
are available through,
there.
I'm assuming, through your different publishers and
Yep, definitely through publishers, but I always suggest people to, order or shop around for their lo into their lower local bookstores. They always love you popping in.
absolutely.
And ask for my books. Ask for books that you don't see on the shelves.
That's how we get them into the bookstores we love.
Yeah, that is.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Suzanne.
Okay. And that was David Lee. For my third guest today, I'm very pleased to welcome Kevin R. Wilson to the show. Kevin R. Wilson grew up in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. He has a Bachelor of Music degree from the University of Calgary, which is probably why his writing contains all those musical references. He lives in Toronto. His debut novel, An Idea About My Dead Uncle, won the inaugural Guernica Prize for Unpublished Manuscript in 2018 and was published by Guernica Editions in 2019. His novel, Call Me Stan, A Tragedy in Three Millennia, was published by Guernica Editions in 2021 and was longlisted for the 2022 Leacock Medal for Literary Humor. Stan on Guard, a sequel to Call Me Stan, was published by Guernica Editions in 2026. His sci-fi noir novel, Tendrils, will be published by Palimpsest Press in early 2027. His work has also appeared in various literary journals and in the short story anthologies This Will Only Take a Minute and Sticks and Stones. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
So glad to have you here. Tell us a little bit about your writing and publishing journey.
Well, I've always written, I wrote short stories when I was a kid, and I wrote a little later in life and tried submitting things a few places without success because I had no idea how difficult it was to get stories placed. And then Guernica Editions decided to have an annual competition for unpublished manuscript, and a very dear friend of ours learned about it and alerted me to it. So I submitted two manuscripts to it. And to my great surprise, the manuscript for the novel, An Idea About My Dead Uncle, made the long list of, was supposed to be 10. They ended up having a tie for one of those places. So a long list of 11. And then to my even greater surprise, it made the short list. And then eventually it was actually the successful submission.
Oh, wow. So, that's exciting.
Yeah. And, I owe my entire publishing career to the fact that my novel had that result in the contest. So as the bio said, it was published in 2019. And the Guernica Prize continues every mm-hmm. spring. They announce.
Yeah, it's a yearly event, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that also was a foot in the door with Guernica. So I submitted the novel Call Me Stan, and again, as the bio said, it was published in 2021 and longlisted for the Leacock. Mm-hmm. 10 novels were longlisted, didn't make the short list, but I was thrilled that it got the recognition that it did by being placed on the long list. And it's taken a while for its sequel, Stan on Guard, to make it to publication. You have to write these things, and you have to go through the process, and then the process takes a while. But so, yeah, just this past March, Stan on Guard was released also by Guernica.
Oh, that's great. And so, and you said you're working on a new book now.
I'm working on a third and final Stan book.
Oh, okay, okay.
I have a first draft of that I'm now going through with my editorial eye. But I think you're probably referring to Tendrils, which is a departure. Mm-hmm. I just, at some point along the way, while I was working on the Stan narratives, I had this idea, what would a sci-fi noir look like?
Mm-hmm.
And really, I think that was a slightly naive question, because Blade Runner is definitely a sci-fi noir, but I was coming at it kind of cold and dug into what the common tropes were of film noir, and came up with the concept for Tendrils, which the world building structure is a company based in Saskatchewan has developed a brain implant that allows people to access essentially the internet directly using their thoughts, and a prototype version of a new development in that regard has gone missing, and they hire a down-at-heel Boston private investigator, military veteran, hard-drinking, kind of under the radar, to help them try to locate this prototype tech.
Well, that sounds really interesting and definitely a bit of a departure from your Stan series. So I think Call Me Stan and Stan on Guard would be classified more as historical and humorous. How did you end up kind of combining those two genres?
Well, you've mentioned again in the bio that there's an awful lot of music in the stuff that I write. I had an idea that became the germ of Call Me Stan. The opera composer, 19th century German opera composer Richard Wagner, was a just vile anti-Semite, but also had wanted to write an opera about the Buddha, which he never did. And the cognitive dissonance there was just astonishing to me. So I knew I wanted to do something with that, but I didn't know what. And then what intersected with that was the idea of the legend, the myth, whatever, of the wandering Jew, this cursed immortal who wanders the earth either as a reward for something or to atone for something, or because he's awaiting the second coming of Christ, or the legend varies. But so I thought, well, what if my narrator is that guy, and he interacts with Wagner in Zurich during that period, but then all of history becomes my sandbox. And so I had other eras that I wanted to write about. I decided I wanted to dig into Norse mythology, and the sources we have for North mythology include Icelandic stories, Eddas, that try to fit the Norse mythology into a Christian context by saying, well, these characters, Thor and Odin and so on, were really refugees from the fall of Troy. And they worked their way up through Europe. So again, that just gave me so much scope to play around in my new historical sandbox. The books tend to get classed sometimes as science fiction or fantasy, I think partly because the character is essentially immortal, maybe because it was mistakenly thought to be time travel fiction when the first came out. But yeah, I think of it as more like weird historical fiction, weird because the narrator is essentially immortal. But as I was writing the guy, just what naturally evolved from that was my own tendency to be a wise ass and to make my narrator a wise ass and to comment wryly and anachronistically about the past from his perspective in the present day.
Oh, well, we can't wait to hear. You're going to be reading from Call Me Stan. All right. Well, we can't wait to hear it anytime you're ready.
I'll read a bit from Stan on Guard.
Oh, sorry, from Stan on Guard. Okay, perfect.
Stan on Guard has two narrators. There's Stan, the wise ass, and a nemesis he picked up by the end of the first book. And the second book is a braided cat and mouse present day story of the Trojan princess Troon trying to track Stan down to finish the job she thought she'd done by shooting him, she thought, to death in Berlin in the 1950s. So I'm actually going to read a bit from Troon's narrative. She's not
Okay.
the kind of wise ass that Stan is. I really wanted them to have distinctive voices, but I also wanted to retain the humor, so I had to find ways to craft her narrative to still have kind of oblique humorous references without having her trespass on Stan's voice. Since these days we are all Odyssey all the time, I'm going to read a passage from Troon's subversive retelling of the Odyssey tale, or parts of it. They made Odysseus a hero. Of course they did. The Achaeans loved their tales of heroes, slaying beasts, bedding nymphs, staples of the Western canon. On the big screen now, not sung around the fire, guns and cars rather than spears and ships, but the same basic idea. Odysseus wasn't a hero, he was a thug. He and his fellow Achaeans sacked my home over a petty king's pretty wife. They killed my father and my husband and my brother and hundreds of other noble, decent men. They drove the rest of us into the wilderness. When they were done, most of them went home to their families. But Odysseus liked the sacking and killing too much to follow their example, so he gathered up the dregs of the remaining soldiers and spent the next 20 years pillaging coastal villages and peaceful islands from one end of the Mediterranean to the other. I've told his story before, the way it happened, over hearths and campfires across the Greek-speaking world. People ate it up. I'm a good storyteller. But the men who retold it over the following centuries didn't care for it as it was. By the time someone wrote their retellings down, the thug had become wise Odysseus, great-hearted Odysseus, Odysseus the kingly man. Crap. Let me set the story straight. I was pregnant when I fled the ruins of Wilusha, Troy, to whoever reads this, probably, if I decide to share it. That traitorous bastard Ishtanu helped deliver my son in a nearby wood. I should have cut his haughty throat afterward. No commoner should see a Wilutian princess so intimately. He had to, of course, to help him, but still. And if I'd killed him, then Tror would be alive instead of dead by Ishtanu's hand, as Ishtanu has now publicly admitted in his self-serving memoir. Read it yourself and see. We were taken to sanctuary by one of my father's Thracian allies, Ishtanu included. Tror grew to manhood there. Once he was self-sufficient, I faked my own death and set out to avenge my people. I didn't tell anyone, not even Tror. He would have insisted on coming. It was something I had to do on my own. I assumed he'd still be there when I came back. I was wrong. I took enough gold with me to buy passage on trading ships. I doubt the Thracians noticed. They didn't keep track of the plunder from their raids. Sometimes the traders tried to get me to pay my passage in other ways. They came away with modest wounds and modified attitudes. One tried more forcefully. He drifted away behind us in the night in a slick of his own throat blood. The first place I landed on the Greek peninsula was called Meliboea. I disguised myself as a man. I was taller than most women of the time, and I'm more broad-shouldered even now, and bought a few rounds in a wharfside tavern. Wine loosens men's tongues. Free wine loosens them more. Once I had a half-dozen carters and laborers at my table, I started teasing out what I could about the sack of my city. Our king was there, you know, Philoctetes. Rotten bastard. Watch yourself. Fine man he was. Was. A sip and a nod. Fair enough. Not now? I asked. They went silent. I signaled for more wine. One of the men looked around cautiously and lowered his voice. Getting old. Stays shut in his palace, neglects his duties, letting the whole kingdom go, really. They all stared sadly into their cups. Then one straightened up and smiled. None to beat him in his prime, though, him with that bow of his. The rest muttered in agreement. Good archer? The man nudged his neighbor and chuckled. Just ask that Trojan prince, eh? I stiffened. Trojan prince? Him who kidnapped Menelaus's wife, started the whole mess. Gorgeous, that Helen. Well, saw her then, did you? Well, no, but she had to be, didn't she? You don't send 1,000 ships after a donkey face. They all laughed at their friend's wit. I didn't. I'd had a sister-in-law named Helen. One of my older brothers brought her back from a trading mission years before. They couldn't keep their hands off each other. Pet names, private jokes. It had made me gag. My brother Paris, Prince of Wilusha, Troy. Not that I ever bought the Achaean excuse that they had come for my sister-in-law. She was pretty enough, sure, and I don't doubt Menelaus's pride was hurt when she left him. But you don't mobilize a war fleet because a fellow king gets cuckolded. You get him drunk and let him wail. Take him to a brothel. Mock him at your feasts. You mobilize a war fleet because you want land, or trade, or plunder. Wilusha had commanded the only shipping route from the Aegean to the Black Sea. Not everyone was happy about that. I set my goblet on the table to steady my hands. Took down a prince, you say? Your king? Put an arrow through his neck at 100 paces. 200, I heard. Soon they were shouting over one another to see who could come up with the goriest retelling of my brother's death. That made me want to gag, too, but I didn't. I focused on the immediate reality behind their stories. My brother's assassin was within walking distance.
Oh, you leave us on a cliffhanger.
I do.
Oh, that's
Time
excellent.
Is limited, Suzanne.
Pardon me?
Time is limited here.
Oh. Well, that was excellent. Oh, I'm sure people will love to read this book. It's the history, obviously. You've done a lot of research to capture the time and the elements of the historical character so well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I love the research part of it. I do an awful lot of that before I even start crafting the stories.
Yeah, the voice is very much in the time. That's wonderful. Well, thank you. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
I'm online at krwilson.ca.
Okay.
And I'm on socials at krwbooks.
Okay. And people can also access your books through Guernica's website?
Yep.
Okay.
The landing page on my website has a link to where people can get the books either directly from Guernica or various other ways, including the Canadian Independent Bookstore Association's Shop Local widget, which if you enter your location, will give you all the independent bookstores in your area that have copies of it.
Oh, that's great. Okay, well, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you, Suzanne. It's been wonderful to be here.
And that was Kevin Arleson. And finally today, we have What's in a Name, where we ask local independent bookstores to tell us how they came up with the name of their store. We're fortunate today to have Vanessa from Lockwood Books in St. Thomas, Ontario. Welcome. How long has your store been open?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Lockwood Books has been open for just over 5 years now. We celebrated our 5-year anniversary just last month.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So can you tell our listeners, how did you come up with the name of your bookstore?
Okay, well, it's pretty simple. Our Lockwood Books, our last name is Lockwood. We always say that our 9-year-old son is the CEO. He's looking forward to inheriting our bookstore.
Oh, wow.
We thought of other names for sure. When we first were opening, we started as an antique booth in London. And so we wanted to come up with like this really catchy name that people would be drawn to this little 7x7 booth. But the more we talked about it, it's like, we already have a cool name. Let's just call it Lockwood Books. And like no further discussion was needed. And our little booth, we've grown into a brick and mortar bookstore here.
That's amazing. I know, because when I heard Lockwood Books, I assumed it was just, you'd chosen it because it was just a really cool name. Because it reminds me of like, you know, Mr. Lockwood from, I think it's from Jane Austen. And you've got like, there's different characters in you know, literature called Lockwood. And it's just a really neat name. So it made perfect sense that it would be Lockwood Books. But now that, and so good for you guys.
Thank you.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Lockwood Books, you're located at 488 Talbot Street in St. Thomas, Ontario, correct?
That is correct, yes.
So if our listeners want to search you out and go to a place with a really cool name, that's where they'll find you. Thank you so much for being with us today. If you're an independent bookstore owner and you would like to share how you came up with the name of your store, let me know. And that's our show for today. Thanks for joining us. Reader's Delight airs on the fourth Sunday of every month. Tune in again on September 27th from 2 to 3 p.m. where we'll be featuring 3 new writers and another What's in a Name bookstore story. So don't forget to support your local authors and local independent bookstores. Until next time, keep calm and read on.
This is KW Con. Songs and music by musicians from Kitchener, Waterloo, Cambridge, and all of Waterloo Region on CKMS FM 102.7.
Time. Of what I thought of what happened, I can seem to realize that sometimes you've got to let it go. So I skated down to Dufferin. I feel metal in my mouth. You make a promise, break a promise when I ask you for your help. I've been waiting for the day that you'd walk back into my life, and it sounded so peculiar, but I had to see it right. I hold you close, bite into you, and tell you you feel warm, and you promise me, still promise me, that you'll still hold me closer when it storms. Thank you. does it feel to be one of us? How does it feel to be one of us? No.
Hey, this is Turner from Woodhawk out of Calgary. You're listening to CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo.
Looking for fresh local produce in Waterloo Region? Visit the Youth Food Markets, where local high school youth are growing, harvesting, and selling fresh food through Pay What You Choose markets. Youth in Food Systems is a program of Seeds of Diversity Canada that helps young people build leadership, business, and food skills while making fresh produce more accessible in our communities. Join us every Wednesday from July 15th to August 26th at Eastwood Collegiate Institute and Victoria Hills Community Center in Kitchener from 4 to 6 p.m. or Fiddlesticks Community Center in Cambridge from 3 to 5 p.m. For more information, visit youthinfoodsystems.ca. We hope to see you at the market.
Folks, you got Dr. Swamp here on CKMS 102.7 FM Waterloo Radio. It is the place to be for independent local music trying to make things happen.
Hi, this is Don Jansen from Radio Waterloo. I'm interrupting your favorite show for an important message. Radio Waterloo is 100% volunteer supported. We have no paid staff, and most of our financial support comes from our volunteer show hosts and membership fees. Today, I'd like to ask you, our faithful listeners, to help as well by donating to the cause. Every dollar you contribute will be hugely appreciated and scrupulously managed. So please consider supporting Radio Waterloo and help us to continue to provide a platform for groups and causes in the Kitchener, Waterloo, and Cambridge area who would not have one without this station. Just go to radiowaterloo.ca and hit the donate button, and donate either with a one-time contribution or, better yet, a continuous monthly contribution. All donations will receive a charitable donation receipt. On behalf of the rest of the Radio Waterloo volunteers and other listeners, thank you.